Willkommen zum Podcast Melting Pot – Migration im Dialog. In diesem Podcast sprechen wir mit NachwuchswissenschaftlerInnen aus verschiedensten Fachgebieten, die zum Thema Migration forschen. Ein Einblick also in die Migrationsforschung über die Grenzen wissenschaftlicher Disziplinen hinweg. Organisiert wird der Podcast vom Nachwuchsnetzwerk des Interdisziplinären Zentrums für Integrations- und Migrationsforschung an der Universität Duisburg-Essen.
Hallo miteinander und willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Melting Pot, Migration im Dialog. Hello and welcome to a new podcast episode. My name is Dennis and I'm glad to host this episode with my colleague Laura.
Hallo.
As you probably noticed already, this is going to be another episode in English. This time we want to talk about forced migration, and in doing so are going to take a more governance-centric perspective. On one hand, we are going to talk about the intricacies of policy implementation, and in doing so we will talk about more concrete changes by the example of Kenya. Kenya is one of the biggest refugee-hosting countries in Africa, and undergoing currently somewhat some changes in line with the implementation of the United Nations Comprehensive Refugee and Response Framework. On the other hand, we want to have a more general conversation about hands-on experience in policy advisory and consultation and the associated research. As usually, we invited an expert in the field as our guest. Today, this guest is Michael Uwizo. He's a researcher on migration, refugees and displaced people at Manzeo University and an experienced practitioner. Hello, Michael.
Hello, and thank you.
Okay, starting off, as usually, we want to introduce you with our either-or questions. And my first either-or question is regarding about your dual role as researcher on the one hand, an academic researcher, but also as your role as a more hands-on practitioner. So which of those roles do you favor more? Which is your favorite role in both of those?
Well, for now, I am in the academic world, so I do more research, but also I, from time to time, you know, do applied research, which is for policy briefing purposes. So I play both, but I tend to lean more towards, you know, more rigorous academic research.
Mm-hmm. And to that end, we always ask about the preferred methodological approach. So do you work more quantitatively or qualitatively in your research?
Well, I tend to work more qualitatively, although I also mm-hmm. engage with quantitative research from time to time.
Great, thank you. We are really keen to hearing on your qualitative research in short time. But starting off with Kenya, which is, to my understanding, your main domain of knowledge, could you probably give us a quick introductory history of refugee policy in Kenya so that we're all on the same page here?
Well, to begin with, I would like to point out that Kenya has what I call a long history of hosting refugees, that mm-hmm. as early as the 1930s, Kenya was already hosting refugees from Ethiopia who had, ran away from Somali during the Italian occupation of Ethiopia in the 1930s. And since then, the numbers of refugees, these were simply small numbers. And since then, the numbers of refugees has, you know, grown from time to time, depending on different crises in the region. Particularly Kenya, the numbers of refugees in the country grew in the early 1990s when we had the crisis in Sudan as well as in Somali, and that led to the creation of the two major camps in Kenya, in the northwestern and northeastern part of Kenya, namely Kakuma refugee camp as well as Dadaab refugee camps.
Okay. Great, thanks. You already mentioned the refugee camps, which is somewhat which is one part of governments, but also with the this implementation of the current refugee response framework, how is that changing, or could you maybe elaborate on the intentions, firstly, in concentrating those refugee populations, and maybe how that intention is probably changing.
That takes us to the question of policy, and one would want to know how does the policy environment look like in terms of refugee management in Kenya. And for a long time, Kenya has had what we call the encampment policy, which requires refugees to stay in what we call gazetted camps. And these gazetted camps are in what we call designated areas in the north, in the general northern part of Kenya. So refugees are expected to stay in those camps and only leave the camps going to places like Nairobi with permission, with special permission from the UNHCR. But Kenya also subscribes to other you know, policies or other regimes. Kenya also is part of the Global Compact for refugees, and of course the accompanying comprehensive refugee response framework, which you have mentioned. So simply speaking, Kenya is a part of the general refugee regimes global at the global level as well as the regional level, and seems to be on the forefront in terms of adopting the policy frameworks that come from the global level. However, we have a new Act of 2021, the Refugee Act of 2021, which is said to, you know, has quite some promising, articles in it, which, you know, somehow will improve on the lives of refugees, improve on the management of refugees in Kenya. However, although we have the act in place, we still are waiting for the regulations that will, you know, turn that act into some action. And we are yet to see what the regulations will look like. Of course, there is what we call a plan, a Marshall Plan in place, which is supposed to also guide the management of refugees. But we are yet to see, you know, the actual what the actual regulations will look like. Something else which I wanted to say was, although we have had an encampment policy, something else which is interesting and has happened in Kenya is that beginning the year 2016, Kenya adopted what we call a model settlement sort of approach, and this started off in the northwest part of Kenya next to Kakuma refugee camp, and it's called the Kalobe settlement. And the Kalobe settlement is just about 3.5 kilometers from Kakuma camp in Turkana County. What happens is that in this settlement, Kenya is modeling a new approach, which is built on what we call choice theory. And it's actually an attempt to move away from the humanitarian delivery models and try to bring about increased economic opportunities for both refugees and hosts. So with this kind of approach, and in this settlement, Kalobe settlement, there are markets and services and so on that are shared between refugees and host populations. Because what Kenya has done is to, within this settlement, is to have refugees to live with hosts side by side, as opposed to living in a camp. And something else that they also do is there has been projects that are, you know, developing, for example, agricultural production together within Kerobeya settlement. Also, the rearing of livestock by both refugees and hosts, so that they can increase, you know, food sustainability and economic self-sufficiency. So that is happening in Kerobeya camp. However, it is yet to be, you know, studied to be able to come up with what is working, you know, and what is not. But so far, there has been quite some positive, reports from the studies that have been conducted in terms of the living standards and economic opportunities within Kerobeya settlement compared to Kakuma refugee camp, and so on and so forth. So there has been studies and so on that have been conducted, but I must say that yet more is yet to be done for us to be able to say that the Kerobeya settlement approach is actually working. All this is an attempt to achieve what we call durable solutions to the refugee situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's very interesting. I get the sense that you're quite, it seems that you're a bit ambivalent about the outcome of the of those new projects. I think you already mentioned in a pre-interview that there are often some gaps between the communicated mission statements from top down, and there are also like implementation gaps between the national and the communal and the local levels. Is that something you see in those camps too?
Yeah, I must say, for example, that and I agree with you that the ambivalence is from the experience, from my interactions with refugees in both the camp and the settlement, and from my interaction with the host community, you know, around the camp and in the settlement, while much is being said, is being presented as happening and working, there are, you know, on the contrary, there are all voices that are beginning to say that no, it's not working. For example, the creation of Kerobeya settlement in itself has had negative effects on Kerobeya Center. Remember, there's a center where the host community originally lives, but there's also the settlement. So the settlement has sort of robbed the center, which is for the hosts, of businesses. So, hosts are somehow already complaining that, it has taken away a certain, amount of their livelihood opportunities. So that's where the ambivalence comes from. There has been ambivalence. The ambivalence is also to do with whether this whole idea of livelihoods is working or not. Because on one hand, whereas we are talking about Kakuma and refugee economies working and so on and so forth, there are certain sections of refugees that feel that, economically they are stifled. Why are they stifled? They are stifled because, for example, first and foremost, the policy environment is not enabling, because we have not done, as a country, we have not done away with the encampment policy. And once living in encampment, it takes away a certain level of agency which the refugees would have otherwise practiced. So if you are supposed to do business, for example, and you in that business, you expect to get your, for example, merchandise and so on from far-flung places like Nairobi, yet you do not have permission to travel out of the camp and into Nairobi. So that in itself is disabling. Disabling mm-hmm. to the extent that although refugees would want to do business, they are stifled in one way or another. And there are many other factors that, you know, constrain the refugees from integrating, from becoming a part of the communities that we want them to become a part of. For example, one of the issues that is coming out is what I would call the national government security narrative. And the national government security narrative presents refugees as a security threat, and particularly refugees from certain communities, such as the Somali community. So this seems therefore also in turn to influence the host's perceptions of the same refugees. And once that happens, then it becomes a barrier in itself to the integration of refugees, because first and foremost, they are seen as a security threat, and they are treated also as a threat. And this, you know, breeds conflict between the refugees, you know, and the hosts. So many, you know, many reasons for the ambivalence. And the ambivalence is not just coming from a researcher like me, but the ambivalence is coming from the experiences, from the lived experiences, and from the research that we have done on lived experiences with both the refugees, you know, and hosts. One of the ambivalences, for example, is that as much as we are talking about the comprehensive refugee response framework, which is supposed to take us more towards the inclusion of refugees, the questions arise around participation and whether and to what extent refugees are able to even participate in different levels, whether national, local, or even at the camp level. From previous research which I conducted, where I was looking at the question of participation, it came out that, you know, much as on paper it is said that refugees are involved in decision making around issues around within the camp, yes, they are involved, but the involvement comes out as tokenistic, where you are invited to a meeting and the agenda has been decided, and all you do is do some kind of acclamation. Whether that is what we want to call inclusion or participation is another question, yeah. You know, altogether. So I'm trying to explain therefore the kind of ambivalence, and that mm-hmm. on paper, what we are aspiring to do from the global, regional to national level is one, but what we are actually mm-hmm. achieving may not be exactly what we are striving, we are saying we want to do, and therefore opening up what I would call space for a revision of mm-hmm. some of the things that we have on paper, and perhaps a reflection, further reflection on, you know, the practice that is.
Mm-hmm. And what is also really quite interesting is that you have those different viewpoints from which you look at those things and can see, okay, this is on paper and this is how it's actually working on the level where it's supposed to have an effect on, because it's been mentioned before, you're balancing different roles as practitioner, political consultant, and academic researcher, which is really quite fascinating, and also the reason we'd be happy to learn more about it. So first, and well, yeah, it might sound like asking about the chicken or the egg, but and you already said that you're quite more occupied with doing research right now. But what did you start with? Did you start out as an advisor and then come back to into academia to do research, or did you start out as a researcher first and foremost and then used your insights to do advisory work?
For about 17 years, I was, I would call it in the humanitarian sector.
Mm-hmm.
And I was particularly doing work related to peace building.
Mm-hmm.
But peace building amongst the displaced populations in Kenya and in the East Africa region more generally. So I ended up implementing projects within different refugee camps. For example, in the Ngara refugee camp, where we did quite a lot of work around peace building, around providing psychosocial help, and so on and so forth. In Kakuma refugee camp as well. So I did, you know, such related work, and also did quite a lot of work in refugee organizing, trying to assist in support refugee groups to organize themselves, particularly around the theme of peace building. So, for example, we had if I remember those years in the early 2000s, when we had, for example, the Sudanese Women's Voice for Peace, which was a women's peace organization, you know, led by women, started by women, and all of them Sudanese women. And the role we played, and by that time I was working at an organization called People for Peace in Africa. And what we did was to provide a supportive role to the organization. And what the organization was doing was peace building, first and foremost within the camps, but also in South Sudan, where they, you know, originated from. So I, you know, did a lot of similar work for about 17 years. And then after that, I thought that perhaps it was time to take all that consolidated experience to the classroom. And that is how I ended up at the university to teach and also do research. So I therefore now, you know, took a different role. This is about around 2010. I decided to take a new role where I was now in the classroom using that experience, those experiences, to teach students, to enlighten students on, you know, practically, and give them, you know, practicum on some of the experiences I had heard. And then, of course, it goes without saying that I now went into research. Previously, we did research, yes, but it was not rigorous, I would say, research. It's the kind of, you know, studies that you conduct, or that NGOs and so on conduct, and for purposes of enlightening or shedding light on what they are doing and improving on programming and so on and so forth. But now I do more of the kind of rigorous research that academics, you know, engage in. But at the same time, I find myself also in the policy arena, where I engage with policymakers. And when you want to engage with policymakers, then the kind of approach becomes slightly different. Different in the sense that you are now trying to influence, you know, to provide solutions to certain issues, certain challenges within the society. So it's not easy, but it's about juggling when are you you know, purely academic researcher, you know, doing research for research purposes, but also when are you the policy person who is trying now to, you know, advise policymakers on what to, on the practical things that need to be done. But all that is because of the environment we find ourselves in, because of the kind of challenges that we are confronted with from time to time. It's also because we also do not have too many, for example, in Kenya, researchers engaged in matters forced displacement. So we are therefore, you know, forced to play these roles and as much as possible. But what we are also doing as academics in the country is to, as much as possible, try to engage with policy makers as well as practitioners, so that we bring our point of view from the research that we conduct to be able to communicate to policymakers and researchers and practitioners on what we have obtained from the ground. Most of the time, it is not very rosy, in the sense that policymakers and practitioners may not be very happy with some of the revelations that we make. But it's rather because we when you do rigorous research, you are bound to unearth, you know, things that policymakers or practitioners would rather be buried, and you know, be seen some for some things to be seen to be working. But you know, you're forced to. That's our call, and that's our mission. You know, particularly as researchers, to be able to do that. But from time to time, when I'm invited, for example, by different institutions to assist in a study, then we try as much as possible to fit within those boundaries, and you know, help as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I myself, and I think most of our listeners do too, we know that there's a huge difference in how you handle and present results, whether it is for an academic audience or a non-academic audience. So, yeah, I think you could sing a song about that. And I was going to ask earlier if you would call it an easy task to bring those different groups together. But from what you said, I hear that there are maybe even some tensions. Would you call it tension, or is this, yeah?
Yeah, from my experience, bringing policymakers and academicians and perhaps even practitioners in one room is not easy. Because on one hand, the policy people want to prove that certain policies are working, want to qualify certain policies as good on one hand. But on the other hand, we have practitioners also who are pushing certain agendas because they want things to fit within their programming preferences. And so they would, you know, try to influence discussions in a certain direction. But on the other hand, we have academicians who do research for research, and who will therefore, you know, from time to time poke holes on policies, but also poke holes on practice. And that sometimes is not easy. It's a difficult juggle, particularly when you find, as an academic, when you find yourself in a totally policy environment where you are supposed to even check how much you say, how you say it, how you write it, and so on and so forth. As academics, we write. what we find out is what we write. But when you go to the policy, from the policy perspective, then it is something changes. You are expected to use certain language. There are different interests that are now being taken care of, whether it is political party or different stakeholder interests in there, whether it is donor country, blah, 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 interests and so on that needs to be taken care of and so on and so forth. So that becomes, in my opinion, a different juggle altogether.
Mm-hmm. So for the last question, how would you say does it work successfully to bring different groups together? Do you have maybe any tips to share with us from your experience?
I think the first thing is to recognize that mm-hmm. these are different constituencies and that they exist and do their things differently. And to encourage those constituencies not to fear to come together and not to and to also come with an open mind that there could be something that the other constituency has got to say which might be interesting for what I do and how I do it, no matter how it may sound. So, first and foremost, encouraging open-mindedness in some of these processes to be able to bring these different constituencies together. But also to try as much as possible to make it frequent, because sometimes we engage once and leave it at that. And then each one goes back to their own cocoon and believes that what the other person is doing is wrong, what I am doing is the right thing. So encouraging some kind of frequent exposure of what each one is doing and the perspectives where they are coming from so that some learning can begin to take place. It doesn't happen automatically, but different constituencies begin to see the value of what the others are doing. And there's one more constituency which I'm forgetting and which we have worked a lot to also bring within this same room. And that is the displaced themselves, the displacement affected communities themselves. Because many a times we are making policy, or we are programming, or we are researching, displacement affected communities without their very involvement. So you find that the displaced affected communities, for example, have been over researched, and they are themselves contributing very little to what is going on. They are fatigued also to some extent, and so on and so forth. So how do we bring them in as well in this kind of dialogue and in this kind of processes? So that has been our agenda, especially at Maseno University, where I teach in Kenya.
Mm-hmm. And this is also a really, really important key takeaway for today. So, Michael, thank you for these insights and also for your time today. So for now, there's nothing left for us to do but ask you if there's anything else you would like to add for this episode, since we are at the end of it, or if there's anything that has perhaps been missed out. So we call it the famous last words, and those are yours now.
My famous last words is that for policy to happen, for practice to happen, there is need for evidence. And that evidence can only be, brought out by researchers. So I'm only encouraging an environment where these different constituencies speak together, speak to one another, And therefore, we are then able to generate good evidence for good policy, for good practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for being our guest today. And thank you, Dennis, for co-hosting today, and also to our audience. Thanks for listening, and until next time. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Das war's mit dieser Ausgabe des Podcasts Melting Pot, Migration im Dialog. Für mehr Informationen über die Arbeit unseres Netzwerkes und für Updates zum Podcast findet ihr uns auf Twitter unter @incentim. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal.